part of what I'm trying to do is just show all the different forms of facelessness that the United States has imposed and tattooed onto Salvadoreños.
Uno, dos, tres.
Hey, what's up? Welcome to In the Thick. This is a podcast about politics, race, and culture. From a POC perspective, I'm Maria Hinojosa.
And I'm Julio Ricardo Varela.
We have a very special guest joining us from San Francisco, California, is Roberto Lovato. He's a journalist, author of a new book. It's called Unforgetting, a memoir of family, migration, gangs, and revolution in the Americas.
Yeah.
Puro, puro salvatruco salvadoreño, Roberto. Yeah. Welcome to In the Thick.
Happy to be con ustedes, mi gente.
I love it.
So the truth is that most of the time, like, I don't know, but journalists, we call each other by our last names. It's weird. So I really know Roberto as Lovato. I'm like, so what's up, Lovato? You know, so it's kind of like, if I end up calling you that, just it's out of love.
Okay, Hinojosa.
So Lovato, your book is super raw. It's super honest. It's very unfiltered because, I mean, how other can you write a memoir that deals with the history of El Salvador?
Yeah.
And your own family's history and the complicated, long-standing, difficult relationship between the United States and El Salvador. You write a lot about your struggles, the traumas, the violence, things that you've witnessed firsthand, or that you realize were passed down to you from previous generations handing down trauma. So you talk about the rise of gangs in both El Salvador. Obviously, the gangs started on the streets of Los Angeles. Child refugees, mass migration, the role of the United States in all of this, and this really intimate look into Central America that, well, we're going to talk about the fact that, you know, I know this place deeply, but most journalists, they don't understand Central America and El Salvador from this perspective, porque eres salvatruco, which is a lovely way of saying he's Salvadoran. And really, the title, Unforgetting. So talk about the title Unforgetting and what you mean and why this notion of unforgetting is so central to the Salvadoran story, both here and in El Salvador.
Well, that's part of the motivation actually for writing the book. I, on a personal level, grew up in a family of secrets. Surprise, surprise. I don't know if anybody else had that experience.
Yes.
But I grew up in a household full of my mom's family's pictures, but none of my father's family's pictures for some reason. And it was just something that was not questioned. And my dad had, you know, I love my dad, but he had a lot of secrets. So there's a personal part where my experience as a young kid here in San Francisco, you know, it wasn't exactly a hardcore clique, but I was, you know, we were robbing, we were stealing cars, we were dealing drugs, we were taking drugs, we were violent, and we were doing things that adolescent rebels do. I also come out as things I did in my young adulthood after I became a born-again Christian, which is unbeknownst to many. I was going to be a preacher.
Yeah, that was definitely, I was like, ooh.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was going to be a preacher, but I had to get out of a certain dangerous lifestyle I was leading and became a born-again Christian. Like many youth are targeted by these, you know, they're called youth ministries, and they're really right-wing, ideological, brainwashing, fucking, what do you call it?
Thank you. Thank you for pointing it out. Well, because you know what's happening in our communities, and we're seeing this reflected in the vote, is that we don't realize how, como se han metido under the guise of preaching love and acceptance and getting into the, you know, getting into your heart.
Yeah, yeah.
And then they end up taking people to their first protest, which is an anti-abortion protest. And it's like, you're kidding.
Yeah. I got on my knees, as you'll see in the book, I got on my knees and I prayed for the election of Ronald Wilson Reagan.
Oh my God.
And no, it was really, it's funny and ironic because people that know me, God, that guy, that's crazy. But the truth is, that's what I did from the corner of 21st in Valencia at a storefront church called the Open Door Alliance. And eventually I woke up, I was reading all the time and I, you know, started going to Berkeley and arguing with my German philosophy teachers and eventually said, you know, fuck this right-wing church. I'm going to El Salvador to find myself. And I went and I found the Salvadoran Revolution. And again, unbeknownst to most people, I came back and was going back and forth between El Salvador and the U.S. when I decided to go to El Salvador to stay for a while. And I joined the FMLN guerrillas as an urban commando.
Okay.
This is a fucking movie.
Which, by the way, people who don't know El Salvador well, they don't realize that a lot of what was motivating the awareness of the revolution in El Salvador was actually Catholicism, was religion.
Yeah,
liberation theology. Yeah,
was Oscar Arnulfo Romero, who was saying, you cannot massacre people. You cannot massacre people.
Yeah, I was brought to that later. I was actually reacting to enslavement theology that many Central American and other Latino families experienced. You know, there was you could even say there was a counterinsurgency movement by the U.S. state to use religion, evangelical religion, and in some ways Catholic religion, although with the exception of liberation theology, as a form of counterinsurgency to basically brainwash massive numbers of people into, docility and acceptance of the status quo. And I was never born for that. I was the rebel in my family. I was a rebel in school. And then I rebelled against the right-wing church. And then I rebelled against the state. And I guess these are some of the best parts of me that I had not been public about. I had basically forgotten them.
Yeah.
And so, in philosophy class and in, studying theology, I came across this Greek concept called aletheia, which is a Greek term for truth, but it also means not forgetting, unforgetting, because it was believed that the dead, when they died, they went into the underworld and had to cross the river known as the Lethe River, right? And the Lethe River was where the dead had to forget who they were when they were living. And so the poet Roque Dalton said that Salvadoreños were born medio muertos, half dead, in 1932.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
And I took that to heart. I learned that phrase early on when my cousin dug poetry from under an almond tree and clandestinely shared it with me in his room, even though I didn't really know what he was telling me, sharing this poetry with me, this revolutionary poetry in the middle of El Salvador on the verge of a savage civil war. So being half dead echoed with me. And eventually, as an adult, I realized what the great poet was talking about. And I decided to write a book that paid homage to that and to the fact that I went from being half dead to being more fully alive by way of the Salvadoran Revolution.
Mm. Wow. So full disclosure for everyone who's listening, I've had the honor of not only publishing Roberto several times, like pre-Futuro Media at Latino Rebels and like when Latino Rebels became part of Futuro Media. And Roberto actually has been writing for Rebels, since 2012, 2013. So your words and your prose, you've created a chronicle of intellectual honesty that I've always admired you as an editor and as a fellow journalist, Roberto. And I have to say that because I'm incredibly proud of you coming out with your story. And the one thing that struck me about this book, because maybe it's like a, this whole father-son thing.
Yeah, it was deep.
The most Latin American, especially when it comes to, I think, Latino men, right? And this is what really hit me, Roberto. And I tell you this as a brother, as a colleague, as a friend, of all the late night conversations we've had and the phone calls and everything. But I never knew this about you. Mm-hmm. You've shared a lot with me, but you never told me about the relationship with your dad, Ramon. And you talk about unforgetting. There's this culture of silence that you're grappling with, especially when you tell Ramon's story. So you go back, you mentioned 1932, but you start in the early 1930s when El Salvador was bearing the brunt of the Great Depression and the indigenous-led revolution began, right? What quickly followed was La Matanza, which was the slaughter of tens of thousands of mostly indigenous people by the government. And there are all these layers, right, at play with your father's own indigenous roots, right, and his silence around that when you were growing up. And that same silence against indigenous people in the country, it was only in 2014 when El Salvador finally ratified its constitution to officially recognize the indigenous community. That's 6 years ago, guys. So talk about the struggle about understanding your father's life. Like you said, one that's been shrouded in silence, and how the erasure of the indigenous community in El Salvador is at the heart of the story.
Absolutely. Thank you for those generous words, Julio.
I love you. I'm sorry, Maria. It's like, I'm so proud of him because he's one of the best writers I know. And I know I get very, as an editor, I rarely get the opportunity to tell that to fellow writers that I publish. So,
and they need it because, it took you a while to decide to kind of write this book.
Right.
And you basically had to refocus your life in order to write this book. So we do appreciate that.
Thank you, Maria, because you, you know what the Central American and the Salvadoran struggle are in intimate ways that most journalists don't and won't.
We'll talk about that in a minute.
Yeah. And so talking about my dad was a challenge because when you write a memoir, you have to be honest. And if you're going to be honest about your parents, you got to be honest about their imperfections.
Yeah.
And the effect those imperfections have on your psyche, on your soul, on your body. And I had to be a little bit honest about that. Not a little bit. I had to be a lot of honest because it was as much about the actual narrative, my own story. Like writing this helped me to come to grips with myself in relation to my father. I never thought literature could do that, but it really can. Like I realized the relationship between the patria, right? The country, the nation state that kills indigenous people. That's the nature of nation states, right? Under the hood of any nation state, pretty much are the bones and bodies of indigenous people slaughtered and had their lands stolen, by and large. That's the nation state system created under the Treaty of Westphalia. So there's a relationship between the patria and the padre, right? The political and the personal and the political. And I knew this in my gut, but I never studied it until I decided to write this book. And in the uncovering my dad's secrets, which I don't want to give all of them away because otherwise people won't read the book.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. No tease.
But can I just tease that your dad was out there with like AK-47s, machine guns, guns?
Well, that's yeah.
There was some crazy shit going on there.
Yeah, my dad used to run guns.
Damn.
From San Francisco to El Salvador.
Damn.
Out of what? A place called Hunt's Donuts. It's on the cover of my book. People wonder, why the hell do you have a donut shop?
Oh, that's what it's for?
Yeah.
Don't reveal anymore, because that's like good enough to be like, what?
That's a movie.
I was watching Bruce Lee movies and Godzilla movies and listening to Kung Fu Fighting as a kid while my dad was, you know, doing these deals at Hunt's Donuts and then creating this system to transfer the guns from the U.S. to El Salvador. And he wasn't doing it on behalf of any rebels or anybody. He was doing it to get money to so he could feed all his kids and all the cousins who were starting to come as the situation in El Salvador deteriorated. So I'm kind of like trying to deconstruct the idea of quote-unquote crime and what's really behind families' decisions to do these things.
Yeah.
You know what's funny when you say that, Roberto, because when you look at like media, like how other gun runners, like whether you're like an Irish nationalist or like that's always been celebrated. You know what I'm saying? Like,
well, there's a lot of stuff like that. Actually, the one who originally started the network of not just guns, but a lot of families do this, you know, contrabando, contraband.
Oh, Fayuca in Mexico.
Fayuca. You know, it's like my grandmother was the one who started taking contraband on ships from San Francisco to El Salvador. And then they started escalating it with not just like clothes, but jewelry and then, ooh, you know, electrodomestics and eventually guns.
No, my mother was transporting computers, cassette recorders. That was the Fayuca that we were transporting by car under the pillows when we would cross into Mexico.
Can we just play El Tigres del Norte, Contrabando y Traición? Like,
and also Kung Fu Fighting.
Everybody was kung fu fighting. Those kids were fast as lightning. In fact, it was a little bit frightening.
So, Roberto, you mentioned gangs and how they play a big part in your personal story, but it's also a big part in the political story of El Salvador. And so in the book, you explain how the word associated with gangs, which is Mara, actually originally meant a group of friends, right?
Mm-hmm.
But when a gang in Los Angeles adopted the term in the late 70s, it took on a new meaning, and that was the gang La Mara Salvatrucha,
mm-hmm,
more commonly known as MS-13. We know MS-13 as a group. President Trump spends way too much fucking time talking about that, calling them one of the most violent threats to this country. In July, he went so far as to charge an MS-13 member with terrorism. There's even a moment in your book when you talk about the LA riots in 1992. This is why I love Roberto Lovato, connecting the dots. How then Attorney General William Barr, hello, under the George H.W. Bush administration, went on Face the Nation and blamed gangs for the destruction.
Mr. Barr, I know your investigators have launched an investigation into what connection the gangs in Los Angeles might have had with this riot. What have you found out so far?
Well, we were investigating all the violence, the arson that was involved in the riots. Our preliminary information is that there was significant involvement of gang members at the inception of the violence, also involvement in the spreading of the violence and the arson.
So this would be something that did not necessarily have to do with Rodney King. It was not a reaction, but was a criminal activity. Is that what you're saying to me?
Yes, I think a lot of the violence and the looting did not have much to do with Rodney King. I think a lot of that kind of activity the criminal element taking advantage of the situation.
Well, there was a lot of...
okay, because I have so many thoughts about that clip, but I'm going to let Roberto talk about it. So, Roberto, you write about the Maras, which eventually spread from the United States back home to El Salvador, and you show that this violence, which many times you witness yourself, you've told me about this, and you've said this so many times, is a cycle. And it didn't start in the U.S., and it didn't start with Maras. You actually write about a man you met, Giovanni Miranda, who had been deported back to El Salvador and ended up dying at the hand of gang members. And I'm going to quote this from your book. "My resolve to understand the violence burns hotter with anger, brighter too. But given what I know based on my own intimate history with El Salvador and its many forms of gangs, my anger is fiercest at the most destructive gangsters in the country's history."
Mm-hmm.
"The ones in suits,
mm-hmm,
protected by even more violent gangsters in military uniforms." Mm. So, Roberto, can you explain the cycle of violence, how your journey to understand it led you to the powerful structures at play in El Salvador?
Yeah, it's a lot to untangle there. But the part about William Barr is connected to this larger thing that I came up with that I call the circuits of counterinsurgency policing.
Mm.
Just look at the streets right now. Look at what happened to in Portland. Look at what happened with George Floyd. You're looking at the products of what I call counterinsurgency policing, where, for example, the U.S. sent military advisors to El Salvador to train the military and the death squads. After the war, I document how some of those U.S. trainers went back from El Salvador, guess where, and to train who? To LAPD and other U.S. police departments in urban United States to train them in counterinsurgency policing. And so you start seeing LAPD create these crash units,
yeah,
which were the ones behind the infamous Rampart scandal that showed that the LAPD was intensifying its focus on gangs and doing so more violently, to the point of even shooting, paralyzing, killing young people that were gang members and that were not gang members. And so the gang members that I've spoken to had a sensibility that I had as a kid. It's like, you treat me like a dog, I'm gonna become a fucking wolf.
Damn.
Right? So,
damn.
You know, I know that kind of rage because I was policed like this in San Francisco by Dianne Feinstein's police. They raised my consciousness and I'm grateful for them. So the circuits then go back after the war when William Barr in 92, suddenly he takes 300 FBI agents that are doing, you know, looking for spies of foreign nations, and he starts focusing them on gangs. So then you start having the state really starting to create a new enemy, which is what states do, right? They manufacture enemies.
But the thing about it, Roberto, and some people might also be surprised to know that I know a lot about this history because I became an activist for El Salvador in college. The United States was up in there from the early 1900s and earlier. So there's this connection to Central America on the part of the United States.
Yeah.
You know, and the fact that people just don't see it because we lived through it. Roberto, you lived through it. I lived through it. So Roberto, in your book, you take us back to Reagan, to the Herbert Walker Bush administrations, where from the 1980s on, you note that 97% of political asylum cases for Salvadorans were denied. But there was Ronald Reagan speaking to Congress about Central America in 1983. I remember seeing this for real.
"Central America's problems do directly affect the security and the well-being of our own people. And Central America is much closer to the United States than many of the world trouble spots that concern us. So we work to restore our own economy. We cannot afford to lose sight of our neighbors to the south. El Salvador is nearer to Texas than Texas is to Massachusetts. Nicaragua is just as close to Miami, San Antonio, San Diego, and Tucson as those cities are to Washington, where we're gathered tonight. But nearness on the map doesn't even begin to tell the strategic importance of Central America, bordering as it does in the Caribbean, our lifeline to the outside world. Two-thirds of all our foreign trade and petroleum pass through the Panama Canal and the Caribbean.
So already, who was setting the groundwork for the fear-mongering that's going on now? At that point, it was Ronald Reagan, you know, who was sending, I mean, I remember I used to say this because it was part of the speeches, $1 million a day to El Salvador to prop up the government and the military.
Yeah.
You know, that ended up killing over 75,000 people dead, many of them civilians, most of them at the hands of the government.
85%.
85% at the hands of the government.
According to the United Nations, yeah.
Exactamente.
Yeah.
And, you know, at that time, there was this group, the Faramundo Martí National Liberation Front, the FMLN. I mean, this was a time of revolution in Central America. Nicaragua had happened. The Sandinistas had happened. The next was the Faramundo Martí National Liberation Front, which was actually a bunch of different leftist progressive organizations, from liberation theology to Marxist-Leninists to guerrillas. And the United States... That's what I'm saying. Like, they were there in the 1930s. They were there in the 1940s. They were there in the 50s. They were there in the 60s and 80s. And the first, Roberto, I think you and I mentioned this to you, that in my upcoming memoir, Once I Was You.
Oh, I love this. You totally dropped your book.
Little cross promo there. But Roberto and I are talking about this because I told Roberto that in my memoir, Central America, El Salvador is like another through line.
Yeah.
The first reporting that I did was on a Salvadoran hunger strike right here at Riverside Church. The first detention camp I saw in my life was in Harlingen, Texas in 1986, and it was filled with Salvadorans.
Wow.
My bachelor's thesis in college was written about Salvadoran women refugees on Long Island. So give us a breakdown, Roberto, as to how the United States is in fact a main character in this story, in the relationship between the two countries, and how you put together the fact that it is de aquí y eres de allá. You're from the United States, you're from El Salvador, and and we've been intertwined for a long time.
Yeah, thank you, Maria. And just let it be public, I know people that knew Maria when she was doing her solidarity work in college with Salvadoreños. I have the goods. Call me and I'll give it to you.
Oh, got the goods. Okay. Wait.
Call me.
Wait, I'm texting you like after this show.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
I'm getting some tea.
Yeah. There's documents, there's witnesses. I know it. You know, we can NPR this to death, but this will not be denied. All right.
Oh.
I did a lot of dancing. I was a revolutionary.
There was a
lot of dancing.
What Emma Goldman said is true. That's part of my point in my book is like, part of what I'm trying to do is just show all the different forms of facelessness that the United States has imposed and tattooed onto Salvadoreños, whether it's William Barr after the riots, kind of like, you know, going at gangs and backing it up materially with the FBI and other police forces, whether it's Ronald Reagan kind of painting this anonymous nothing of a threat, or whether it's Donald Trump right now going back at MS-13, they're all faceless. They're all cartoons of Salvadorans that are being used in U.S. history to justify things like intervention. But now the intervention with Trump is inside the borders of the United States because Salvadorans are being used to militarize the internal life of the United States like they did in El Salvador, right? The chickens are coming home to roost. So
how so?
In the book, one of the quotes I open up with is by this judge, Aida Luz Santos de Escobar, who, you know, she kind of just says, well, now everyone is a gang member or a terrorist or a narco trafficker. Maybe next they will go back to just being communists. So.
Wow.
Tan fácil cuando nada más son comunistas y quieren que todo mundo coma.
Sí.
Just make sure that all the people eat is what. Like, can we go back to that?
Whoa. So my book is about U.S. history as a variation on the theme of othering Salvadorans. And, you know, I had to go in and look at the abyss in different ways. I had to go in and look at mass grave sites. I had to go in and look at the heart of those families and those voices that lost all those people. Mm-hmm. I had to go in and meet gang members in clandestine hideouts in some really scary places. I had to go back into my dad's history. I had to go back into my own body, into my own heart, to excavate the things that I had hidden from myself.
Yeah.
So all those things are a way to do kind of like what Carl Jung, the psychologist, calls, you know, looking at the shadow self. So I think in writing this book, I start looking at not just the shadow self of Roberto or of my dad or of El Salvador, or even just the gangs, but also the shadow self of the United States,
yeah.
Right? And Salvadoreños are nothing if not part of the shadow of the United States that it uses to try to prop up its consciousness of itself as a city on a hill, a country of light and human rights, when in fact, the piles of dead bodies in Salvadoran history, the piles of dead bodies in my family, in my subconscious, are a testament to the fact that they had to dehumanize us,
yep,
literally, in order to kill us. I learned that.
Yeah.
One of the biggest lessons I learned from El Salvador was that in order to kill somebody, you have to take away their humanity first.
Yeah.
In order to pass horrific policy like against immigrants, whether you're whether you're Donald Trump doing it openly or Barack Obama doing it materially at the level of the immigrant body that was jailed,
correct,
dehydrated, destroyed, separated, and caged.
Denied due process.
Yeah. There has to be a degree of dehumanization for that to happen, because if you see those kids as Canadian kids, you're not going to do that.
Exacto.
That was my mission. I had to go in and look at the gangs in particular because they're the dominant symbol of what Salvadoran is. And so I had to go in and look at the humanity and find the humanity in people that have been, just like other Salvadorans, dehumanized. And I found it.
Yeah.
I found it.
Wow.
Because in humanizing the gangs, we humanize ourselves because they're human, like it or not.
Correct.
Yeah.
They're a product of a society. They're a product of policies.
Yeah.
Their violence has a history beneath it. And I had to go in and excavate that.
So listen, let's move on to our final segment, which I actually think subconsciously we might have created this for you back in the day. It's called Sin Pendejadas, or basically no bullshit.
So Roberto, you were one of the few journalists at the time who called out President Barack Obama and his administration for his catastrophic immigration record. You know, I've reported about this. I also called him out. We've talked about this a lot here on ITT, that he has one of the highest numbers of deportations during his time as president. And the problem was that he was a constitutional scholar.
Right, right. And I do want to note that Roberto, being his editor at Latino Rebels during these times, during that time especially, you've been very consistent when it comes to calling out presidents, whether it's, you know, Democrat or Republican, for their policies, even the ones that are still, I have to say, you know, they're still, quote unquote, revered by many, like, you know, the Bill Clinton administration of the 90s and the Obama administration. But you also got a lot of flack for that. And I want to personally, like, I remember those years, Roberto, when you would write these pieces and you were getting a lot of shit. And I was like, you're telling the truth. We're publishing you. Screw it. This is what we're supposed to do. And the media coverage, we know the media coverage didn't help because Obama was painted as a strong leader, but when it comes to news on Central America specifically and immigration, all we see is violence, war, and like you said, the constant dehumanization of people in Central America.
So we're going to shift now to talk about what's happening right now in the United States as Latino, Latina journalists. It's a fun time.
2020! 2020!
Not. It's really a challenge, right? I remember when I was in El Salvador, I actually had to wear a t-shirt that said, "No dispares, soy periodista." Don't shoot, I'm a journalist. And they would respect that, you know. But anyway, we know that the United States right now, the politics play a huge role in what's happening to us here as Latinos and in Latin America. And so we've got this election coming up.
Mm.
Joe Biden, Obama's former vice president, and his running mate, Kamala Harris, a former prosecutor from your home state.
Mm.
So as someone who's kind of been a no bullshit journalist for a while.
No bullshit.
So no bullshit, Roberto. What are you making of the 2020 election?
Well, my book has the word revolution in it for a reason. Like when you create subtitles, Maria, you know this, and anybody out there who works with big publishers know that the subtitle has to have SEO value, search engine optimization. People have to be able to find it on the internet. So you got to find words that are popular. So I have some of those words in my subtitle, but there's one word that doesn't have that much SEO value, which is revolution.
Mm.
So the reason I have it on there is because I have something to say about revolution that's not just Bernie's revolution. It's a different way of thinking and being. And I've made a preferential option for returning to my revolutionary sensibility more openly, because I think that we, in the face of the titanic crises we face right now, right? Whether it's Trump and everything that that represents, COVID-19, policing, militarization of the society, You know, if we get through all that, then we got to face climate change on a global scale that's unprecedented in world history. So we're not going to Democrat or progressive our way out of that. We simply won't. We need a more, I think, millenarian sensibility, what sociologists and others call millenarian, in terms of just visionary, radical thinking that gets people to move their minds, their bodies, and their votes and their boots on the ground to really tear shit down. So I'm not in any mood for the kind of discussion of whether Kamala Harris is more Indian or Black.
Damn.
I'm not in any mood to talk about how cool Joe Biden looks with his mask or not. I am in a mood to get Trump out, but we have to simultaneously unforget the fact that Biden and Harris were silent and complicit in the caging, separation, and killing of Central American and other migrants by the Obama administration. If we allow ourselves to forget that, we enable the caging, the separation, the killing by Democrats that happens more silently than Trump. So it's political theater. I'll cast my vote. So what? Me vale. Me vale riata, francamente. I feel more urgency for my family and friends and everyone in the face of the greater crisis than I do. I'm done with thinking Donald Trump is the absolute evil anymore. I don't think just Trump is evil. I think the spectrum of evil is bipartisan.
Validation right there.
Yeah, that's it. And we have to open our eyes and lovingly call these things out. So thank you for doing that, Roberto Lobato, journalist, author of the new book, Unforgetting, a Memoir of Family Migration, Gangs, and Revolution in the Americas. Thank you so much for joining Julio and me on this episode of In the Thick. We really appreciate it.
It's my pleasure and as always, honor to work with both of you, very important and consequential journalists in our community. I just don't mean Latinos.
My God.
Consequential. Damn.
We're going to take that quote, transcribe it, and just put it on the friggin' website. Thank you, Roberto.
I'm Maria Hinojosa.
And I'm Julio Ricardo Varela.
Uno, dos, tres.
Remember, dear listener, go to Apple Podcasts to rate and review us because it's September. Also, remember, you can listen to In the Thick on Pandora, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. I don't want the summer to end. Check us out on the web at inthethick.org. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at In the Thick Show. Like us on Facebook and tell your friends. In the Thick is produced by Nicole Rothwell, Noor Saudi, and our New York Women's Foundation Ignite fellow, Harsha Nahata, with editorial support from Erica Dilte. Our audio engineers are Stephanie Lebeau, Julia Caruso, and Leah Shaw. Our digital editor is Luis Luna. Thanks to Raul Perez for recording me. The music you heard is courtesy of Nacional kept in ZZK Records. We'll see you on our next episode, dear listener. Thank you for listening y hasta la próxima.
Dancing in September. Oh, yeah.
I just did Earth, Wind, and Fire for us.
Dancing in September.
Versus September.
The opinions expressed by the guests and contributors in this podcast are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of Futuro Media or its employees.